Good morning. Today is Tuesday, February the 25th. Joining us this morning really is Fortuna City Manager Barrett Perry.
Good morning,
Brian. Nice to see you.
It's nice to be here.
All right. That's enough of that. Are you ready for our Why Do We Say That?
I'm ready.
Mugwump.
Oh, man. That's not,
I gotta make
not,
up.
Not even a Latin root. That
what is the origin of the word mugwump?
Not even a guess. What somebody says when they crawl out of the tent.
If you would have said teepee, you would have been close. Yeah. Mugwump is an Algonquin Indian word meaning chief. But John Eliot, in his famous Indian Bible of 1663, used it as the equivalent of the word duke. Mugwump was first used as a term of derision in the presidential campaign of 1884, where it was applied to Republicans of means and consequences who refused to support James G. Blaine for the presidency.
All right.
So you had two wide open areas, Indian and political.
Yeah, I missed them both.
Yeah.
With.
Yeah. Is there anything on the ballot next Tuesday that's got you any concern, either in our area or somewhere else throughout the state?
You know, as for Fortuna goes, not that, you know, we're really attacking, no. There's nothing that has me that concerned. I mean, it's, you know, obviously paying attention to the November election. There's a lot of attention on that right now. But again, the disconnect between federal and local, you know.
What I was thinking is, you know, a lot of times we'll see documents or legislation or ballot measures that are in other counties, mm-hmm. somewhere in the state. And everybody goes, you know, if this thing passes, hooray or whoops. And you start positioning kind of, yeah, I'm sure that some of the marijuana stuff was that way for other counties, you know, as Humboldt was kind of starting to do its early steps and they had their spin or their take or what that potential impact could be. And, you know, through the league, through the city managers association.
We see a lot of attention on pending legislation from the league. And, you know, one of them was defeated was one of the, I think it was 50 Wiener proposed. It was on housing, but, you know, taking away some of the ability of local jurisdictions to regulate the types of developments that happen and where they happen. And so I think there's a concern there, but it's one that, you know, the city, we're a real small player in that, but, you know, I guess where we see the impacts, I mean, there's a big focus right now by the state to make sure that cities have their housing elements up to date and that they have the appropriate amount of land or that they have land designated for multifamily and affordable housing. That's a huge push at the state level right now. And so HCD, Housing and Community Development, they're actually, the thing that's different about this is they're actually putting money out for some of the planning. So, you know, a lot of times we see mandates, but we don't see money along with it. And so, you know, when they're a little bit more serious, when they actually send you money too, but it's tough. If you take the money that they put out there for grants, you need to, you know, they put guidelines in place that require you to accomplish what their goals are. And
you mean they're not just gifts?
No. And so those goals are not always consistent with what the public or the city wants to see, but really more along statewide needs, which, you know, there can be some friction in rural areas when, you know, for example, they want to see more multifamily close to transit, especially when you have a bus line that goes all the way around your city and it could be considered close to transit anywhere in town. And then relaxing of those development standards for multifamily or low-income housing can really cause some, you know, planning conflicts with what the city's put forth in their general plan.
The discussion that the governor had with his message last month about homeless and housing and priority and mandates and last Friday Karen was in and talked a little bit about some of the concerns she had. Is Fortuna concerned also about what it might mean either to the city proper or the culture of the general community?
Absolutely. I mean, I think anywhere in the state you'd be crazy not to be paying attention to homelessness. And I think, you know, in particular, the citizens of Fortuna, they value a safe and welcoming environment, as does any city, you know, where you don't have people, you know, sleeping on your streets and creating a nuisance or, you know, doing whatever they might be doing in public. And at this point, I think you have to assume it's going to get worse. And I think we've done pretty well managing What's happening in Fortuna, you know, one of the primary reasons because social services aren't really provided in Fortuna. So we're not seeing the pressures that some of the other cities have, but we're definitely thinking about, you know, how can we get ahead of this and staying behind it? Instead of being reactive, how can we be proactive and how can we solve this? And, you know, there's not really a magic bullet for this. I mean, you could put in stopgap measures and try to address address the immediate need that you see people on the street, and you know you could have a shelter like a stopgap, like you know maybe what Betty Chin's doing, or some kind of a tent village. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you look at what Danco did in Rio Del, and you see an expensive, nice facility that could house people into the future, and maybe that's more of a permanent situation. But none of these are cheap, very tough to sustain, difficult to get people to commit to being in these. You know, maybe you'll get a decent percentage, but there's always going to be a number of people who don't want to commit to what they need to do to be in these facilities. So,
I can't imagine what the public hearings would be like. Also, citing one of those things in pick a neighborhood doesn't matter.
And I don't know that it's something right now. I need to look closer at this, but I don't know that the city can stop one of those transitional housing projects in a multifamily zoned parcel. So there might be limits on what a city can do. And again, we're not into this, but I think that, you know, you are somewhat limited on what a city can do. If they're using it for what the appropriate use, there's certain things that you can't restrict.
In something like that, Merritt, the state, I would suspect, trumps the local. If they say, we are going to do this, or you are going to. I go back to what we saw in Oakland and Emeryville. You know, the meridians between the highway were, I guess, acceptable places for some of these encampments. And I'm thinking, okay, now we want to make something more permanent, is kind of what I got out of the message. Here we go, and you know, if Caltrans has its right of ways, and then you know the Coastal Commission has its area of influence, I would imagine they could probably define any place that could qualify for that.
Yeah, on state-owned properties, within cities, the city has very limited ability to say what the state does on those properties.
More when we come back.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music. ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, Billy Joel, and The Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio. Easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music. Easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Merritt Perry.
Mugwump.
Yeah. Thank you. Some of the challenges I would suspect, Merritt, in doing some of these various projects is because the state has the overriding authority, so much effort and so much time is spent developing general plans and housing elements and all these things we hear about, and the public shows up if they want to or they don't show up, and time, effort, money, all that kind of stuff is put together, and then the state says, and thou shalt, boom. And is there any recognition of the local efforts, or does the state, is it kind of like with the prisons, and they say, you know, we got our mandate, we got to get these folks out of here and handle it local, and it's really just then dropped on your doorstep.
Yeah, I mean, the locals maintain control over the land use and what it's designated for, but where really the pressure gets applied from the state, there's a couple ways, but one of them is that you have to have a compliant housing element, and that, you know, there's requirements that they put on a compliant housing element. So they don't tell you where you have to have certain land designated, but they might have a goal or requirement that you designate a certain amount for multifamily, or a certain amount for emergency, a certain property for emergency shelters.
I am contagious, by the way.
So, you know, the city has to decide where that would and where the best fit would be, and where the state authority really comes in is, you know, telling you that you have to have properties designated for these uses. You can't just come in and say, hey, we don't want any more multifamily, it's all going to be single family, because they review your housing element for compliance with this, and I believe it's the state housing goals. But
so what is multifamily? Is that a duplex, or is that an apartment building?
It's where you have more than one family on one parcel.
Mother-in-law unit?
It could be a fourplex. It could be a apartment complex.
What are those things that Eureka is allowing?
Densities.
You know, the small little mother-in-laws.
In accessory dwelling units, that's another one where the state made a new law that made it easier to have accessory dwelling units in an effort to alleviate the housing. So, you know, they're commonly referred to as mother-in-law units. So if cities didn't update their ordinance to allow accessory dwelling units, then the states would govern. So that's the situation we're in. One of the things that we recently did, I mentioned that the state put some money with housing, so we applied for an SB2 grant. They're basically over-the-counter grants, so we'll be updating our city ordinance to comply with the to include a new accessory dwelling unit section in our zoning ordinance. So ours is out of date, so we default to the state's. And so then we'll update ours, and that'll give the city to really, instead of broad brush like the states, it'll allow us to be a little more detailed with how we want to implement that and if there's changes we want to make. But we need to update it, and that's something that we'll be doing over the next year.
With the state in their homeless edict, I guess it is kind of looking like it's coming over the hill pretty shortly. They had the public camping. Or public land camping,
the Boise decision.
Yeah,
which
are you starting to see any impact? Are the parks starting to be impacted? Whether it's the ball fields or just the regular parks, are you seeing any of that happening now?
You see people around, you know, people that don't have a home, and they'll be in the parks and other areas. One thing is, in facilities that you have closed, people can't be in closed facilities. So our parks close at 5, and we shut the gate. So you know, definitely, you know, we see people there during the days, and everybody's welcome to be in the park during the days. But at nights, those are closed facilities, so we don't have people camping in our parks at nights. But the Boise decision essentially said, if you don't have a local shelter in your city, that you can't stop people from sleeping in public spaces.
What is the definition of a shelter? Because I know historically Eureka had you know, when it gets really cold.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it was at one point, I know it was just a big warehouse. Okay, and you have whatever inside, you know, needs to be taken care of, whether it's heat or the porta potties and all that kind of stuff. Does that suffice, or is that temporary and that has a different standard?
You know, I'm not sure of the standards that's been developed for that, but I, you know, that's something that, I don't know the exact definition. I have a picture in my mind, but I don't know what the legal standard is, or even if it's been tested at this point. But basically, you know, somewhere for people to go if their only choice is the street. And I assume with any facility, you have to have some basic things. You know, you need shelter from the rain and probably heat and probably a bathroom, those type of things to have it suitable. And, you know, I know that, you know, Betty Chin's in Eureka, I haven't toured it, but, you know, they're converted containers is my understanding. And so
right,
I think
the village,
you can have
yeah.
pretty simple structures, you know, that provide basic shelter and those probably do suffice and bathroom facilities. So
if you had something like that, government run rather than nonprofit run, does that alleviate or meet the standard that the state has and give you more flexibility in other areas?
I think it's a standard that's based on case law and a lawsuit that was saying if you don't have it, you know, that basically said if you don't have a shelter, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't,
you don't score points if you have it.
Yeah, it wasn't based
on, you get hammered if you don't. Yeah,
it wasn't based on statute, but just the case law. And so that's the
which is always nice and clear for you to be able to figure things out, right?
Yeah, I mean, you see trainings on things like this, but you know, I think the houseless population, they're keenly aware of it, and our police are definitely trained, because you know, we don't want to put ourselves in a situation where we arrest somebody for sleeping on a street and then case law says that you can't. So we have to be really careful, because if we arrest somebody for something that there's established case law on that says that you can't do that unless you have a shelter or alternative place to live, then the city's subject to lawsuits. And I don't know if you know this, Brian, but people love to sue cities.
I've heard trip and falls are wonderful ways to start a career. KINS News Information Time, it's 8:30.
Locally owned businesses help our community maintain a distinct personality and to help increase tourism because we don't look like every other place. Small businesses also provide the ability to try on and try out items before you buy and get real expertise, saving you both time and money. When you shop, shop local.
Our award-winning camping department has the gear you need no matter what kind of camping you do. Come in and experience the many benefits of shopping with Pacific Outfitters.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Merritt Perry from the city of Fortuna. Merritt, some of the different challenges that are out there, you know, the interaction between cities and other jurisdictions. Yeah, we've heard those phrases of sphere of influence and all that kind of stuff. On a day-to-day basis, pretty much, does Fortuna control Fortuna? And the county control the county? And other jurisdictions kind of control their areas, and it's the exceptional where there are these overlaps, or is it the other way around?
I'd say generally each area does pretty well controlling, you know, their jurisdiction, but certainly there's overlaps, and those overlaps are the ones that, you know, really, I think, take a little more time to look at. You know, one of the things that, a few overlaps I can think of, I'll give you a few examples. Sphere of influence. You know, when the commercial cannabis came on in the county and Fortuna chose not to do that, we have areas where we have a residential neighborhood immediately next door. We have a multi-acre open air grow. And so you have people in the city who are complaining about something that was permitted in the county. And there's obviously friction there. You know, other areas, you know, think about collaboration. We don't control the state highway system.
That's what I was saying. The highway coming right through the middle of the town.
Yeah, we don't control that state property, but we do have projects. So we've proposed one project that we're working on right now, the preliminary design and environmental permitting to do improvements at the Kenmar interchange to reduce congestion. So one of the things we were able to do, and I think this is a great model, is work with Caltrans and get a cooperative agreement. So they're going to work, coordinate the reviews, and the city will lead the work, and Caltrans will be a partner in working to develop a project that's acceptable to Caltrans. And we actually kicked this off with some grant funds, a couple $100,000 to do a sustainable communities grant to really identify improvements that needed to happen at that intersection. So Caltrans was a good partner there. You know, but also, if you think about roads, one of our recent projects that we're just finishing up is a Rural 20A, and that's an electrical undergrounding project. So I don't know if anybody...
That's expensive.
Yeah, it is. I think our total cost is going to come in around $3 million, but all the...
You're 2.5 blocks on that one?
No, I think we're probably more around 6 blocks or something like that. But essentially, they're putting all, you know, the small, there's a small amount in everybody's electric bill every month that goes towards putting utilities underground to improve aesthetics and livability of communities. And so,
is it safer or easier to maintain if it's under the ground instead of up on the poles?
You know, I think some areas it's safer where you have high fire risk, but I think in Fortuna, you know, 12th Street's not an area that you're really going to have high fire risk. I think it's mostly visual impacts that you're making it look a lot nicer. And when you see areas around town where you don't have, I mean,
it's night and day. You don't think about it,
right,
and then all
right.
of a sudden it's gone, and you wonder what's wrong.
Yeah. So they put a bunch of conduit in, and PG&E's put their wires underground, and they're live, but you still can see the communication lines up there. So PG&E actually cut the top of the pole off of all the poles along 12th Street, removed that, and it's going to take a little longer for AT&T and Suddenlink to remove theirs, but I think they'll somewhere be within the next 6 or 7 months.
So it's kind of like the tree trimming program that they have.
Yeah, they just take right off the top.
Lobotomy,
Same idea.
Okay.
One of the cool things that we were able to do, you know, going into the project, we weren't aware that if we wanted to maintain our streetlights, that they would want us to pay a proportional share of their trenching costs. So they wanted us to pay roughly a third of the trenching cost. For the streetlights. So we said, you know, I don't think we want to pay 30% of whatever, however many million, 2 point something million for that joint trench. So what we did is we ended up putting in some solar streetlights. And I don't know where we have other solar streetlights in the county, but it has a pretty futuristic look. And when the rest of the utility lines come down, it's going to look pretty different. We've also, you know, there was going to be a lot of trench patching. I mean, they really just kind of made a spider web of that road with all the trenches. And so we focused some of our paving money this year, and we just paved the traveled way of 12th Street. So it was really coming apart. And, you know, kudos to our public works staff who, you know, saw the need, put together the funding. We had approval from council last Tuesday night, and we paved it on Wednesday and Thursday.
Oh, really?
And the trenching was done, I think, a week before that. So
hooray for the weather, huh?
Hooray for the weather, and you know, good on our crews for recognizing that the public really would want to see that road improved right now, away.
Do you have the runway lights in there also, so that when people are slowing down, they can see where they are?
Yeah. No, we have our solar street lights up, and so that was kind of tricky because we were trying to put our street lights up, and the old power lines were still in the way, so we got about half of them up, and then as PG&E took down the higher power lines, we were able to put more in. But so it's going to be you know, it looks a lot nicer, and when the rest of those lines come down, it'll look a lot better. And then we're right now in the process of putting together a grant for, you know, rain gardens. They call them low impact design basins to treat stormwater. But 12th Street along that.
You mean gutters?
Well, there's gutters there, but none of it goes underground. So it's like a small creek on either side
of
the
road. Yeah, just kind of runs.
That goes in front of the high school. And so okay. People have wanted to see a change there. So we applied for a grant. So to put some storm drain in with low LID basins is what we call them, or rain gardens. So when this is all done, we could have a nice new paved road. We could have our nice groovy solar street lights, and then have this rain garden. But
so where does the water go if it doesn't run down the street into the creek?
There will be storm drains that would put in as part of that. And we had a storm drain project planned. So if we can be successful with this grant, we'll reduce the cost that we'd have for putting in storm drains, but we'd have to add the water quality benefit, which is the low impact design or the infiltration basin. So basically what you have is you have an area that's exposed to soil, so they can fill up in that area, can infiltrate. And then if the flows get too high, they overflow, and then they go into a traditional storm drain system. So the storm drains will still be there, but there'll be areas where you know, that first flush, you know, we do see a lot of garbage on 12th Street. You know, kids don't always pick up after themselves and throw their, you know, their things in the
popsicle sticks.
So
yeah.
These will also be an area where you can get trash capture, so that trash doesn't end up going into the Eel River. And, you know, it's a short stretch down 12th Street to get to Roner Creek. And, you know, so I think the trash capture will be a big improvement, and then we'll get some stormwater quality improvement. That first flush carries more oils and things that come off vehicles. And so that'll get into the soil, and then the microbes in the soil will help treat that. So it's another thing that the state's really been pushing, that, you know, there are some grant funds attached to it. We've been able to take those grant funds to incorporate these projects, but we're mandated to do these type of projects under our municipal separate stormwater permit. So to the extent we can use grant funds, implement a water quality project, and then reduce our cost for storm drain using the city general fund, it's kind of a win-win.
So in regular guy language, you dig a hole that's deep enough so it can soak into the soil, and then if it saturates, it comes up and flows down the stream, and you've got some filters there to take the garbage and set it aside.
And it better look nice, otherwise people aren't going to like it.
Right, and you're not going to be cutting across your new pavement to connect things.
Yes. It's all, so we didn't pave.
New sidewalks?
We did not pave through the shoulders. We did, we have been fixing some of the sidewalks. The sidewalks are in okay shape, and we've had to take out, where PG&E Trench, we put in compliant driveways and curb ramps. And so we.
Is that the dot, dot, dot things?
Yeah, and just making sure that you meet the grade requirements to comply with Americans with Disabilities Act. So.
Oh, you don't want a lawsuit like the county has?
No.
Okay.
No. We're going to try to stay ahead of that one.
Way to go. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:43.
Are you a business owner looking for financial or technical assistance? An entrepreneur looking to start a new business? The Redwood Region Economic Development Commission and the Small Business Development Center want to help. With business loans, classes, and one-on-one consulting, our goal is your success. We've been helping Humboldt County businesses for over 30 years. Visit us at 520 E Street, Eureka, the Prosperity Center, or find us on the web. The Redwood Region Economic Development Commission and Small Business Development Center. We're here for you.
Good morning, KINS. News and Information Times, 8:48. 2 minutes left with Merritt. Anything else exciting happened last week at the council meeting?
You know, we presented a wastewater project. So, you know, the state has, you know, the city operates under a National Pollution Discharge Elimination System grant, NPDS. And so the city has been working for some time, and actually we're starting to get ahead of schedule on identifying a new location for our wastewater. So that's, we had a presentation from our consultant and city staff last week, and
that's got to be halfway tough to find a spot, isn't it?
It's got to be tough to find a spot. Yeah. So we've been looking around. We did find a location where we could, you know, with good properties. I mean, the key is being away from the river. The requirements are really that your wastewater don't, you know, you don't have a hydraulic connection that can be considered to discharge to the
ocean. And out of the coastal zone too, I would suspect.
And in or out of the
would help to alleviate some issues. Yeah.
So. We basically laid out for the council our conceptual design and our cost estimates. And, you know, it's a big project. We're looking at a cost between $15 and $20 million, and thinking about how we're going to pay for that, where the project's going to go, how we're going to implement that, what grants are we eligible for, and kind of what our preferred solution is. So we've been working for a while, and really we presented that to council. So they had a chance to look at that, and you know, they'll probably be the most costly project in city history, I'm going to guess. I can't think of another $15 to $20 million project the city's undertaken at one time.
Right.
So
I mean, laying down roads probably was, but it was over such a long period of time.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And those were probably a lot of county roads when they were originally
built. Originally. So as you look at something along those lines, is it a 5-year until you site it and get it going, 10 years,
we have a
weeks?
Deadline of 2024 to build it.
To have it completed and functional?
Yep.
I know what you're going to be doing next week. And later on today. Thanks for coming by.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Brian.
See everybody tomorrow.